Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today has been described as the greatest living British novelist. He was born in Glasgow and his first collection of short stories was published in America in the 70s. Since then, he's written more short stories, novels and plays for stage and radio. Twice nominated for the Booker, he won in 1994 with the contentious work How Late It Was, How Late. Often compared to James Joyce and Samuel Beckett, his work has influenced a great raft of writers such as Irving Welsh. Dirt Road is his new book. James Kalman, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thanks.
The Times says that you're probably the most influential novelist of the post-war period. Does praise like that and greatest living British novelist buoy you up or weigh you down?
I suppose over the years, what I tend to do, I won't generalise about it, is that whether a review's good or bad or whether criticism that you receive is hostile or whether it's praiseworthy or praising you as a writer, to a certain extent you have to ignore that because you have to get on with your work. And ultimately for me, I would pick holes in anything. Even the best possible review for me usually means that the reviewer hasn't picked up certain things I know that are perhaps negative. And I feel, there are ways of coping with a statement like that about myself, and I tend to cope with them, I think, because it doesn't really, to be truthful about it, it doesn't affect me at all. The problem is I still have to go and do my work tomorrow morning. I still have to write, I still have to get into stories, and I still have to finish stories and finish whatever I'm working on. And, you're soon brought back to earth when you look at your bank account and how much you've earned from writing in the last 40 years, never mind the last 1 year. And then the door opens and in comes your kids or your grandkids in my case. So, no, it doesn't go to my head. That's the short answer.
Your complete authenticity as a writer has never wavered. And I wondered if we could go back to your childhood in Glasgow, to the very place and the lives that informed your writing.
One of the things about it for me is because I left school at a young age, I left school at 15, which was a year earlier than the young fella of the novel. And I started an apprenticeship at that age, a compositor in the printing trade. And I did that because I'd said to my guidance teacher at the time that anything to do with art interested me. And that was why they put me forward for a job in the printing trade, because of the graphic side of that. And at that time, even at the age of 15, I kind of assumed that I would be involved in art in some way. And when I was about 16, 17 and 18, even to the age of 18, I assumed I would be an artist. I just assumed that without ever doing anything. Most of my reading would have been, where it was literary, would have been regarded as quite advanced for my age. A lot of the reading I did was on the biographies of the artists, and some people who end up being involved in theology or religion, the lives of the saints is very important for them. For me, it was always the lives of the artists. It wasn't just as a teenage male or boy, that the lives led by the artists were exciting, in licentious ways and ways in which, this is you maturing and so on. And that too, but there was something about the way that artists lived their lives that I felt, I suppose, moved by, and at that early age, when I was the artist, I would be influenced by, would be people like Cezanne and Van Gogh and Modigliani, Utrillo and Pizarro, Braque, later painters, and also earlier painters. I kind of liked some of the things that they were doing, I liked early 19th century painters. I liked the French school more than others. But so there was a sense in which I was always kind of involved in thinking, in a sense, or rather, not thinking so much, assuming. There was almost an assumption by myself about what I would be doing in life, that I would be involved in art. And it was not something that would be frowned upon in my family. You know, there is this kind of thing about, James Kelvinus, the working class writer, etc., etc. Well, it's true up to a point, but there's another point where, I mean, one side of my family, it's hard to call them, included three doctors. My grandmother's family, she was the youngest of five, and two of her brothers were doctors. One of her sisters was a doctor, another one was an inspector, or in those days, an inspectrix of schools, you know. So there were always books in my house. I was reading since age of three or something. And my father was a picture restorer and gilder. So sometimes he brought home his work, which was paintings.
And in Dirt Road, you examine a patriarchal relationship. So what was your relationship with your father like?
Well, I had four brothers for a start. There were five of us. So my relationship was probably fairly typical. It was antagonistic. And my wife, she would be saying, when she heard myself, my father talking, when we just got married, it used to worry her because the anger that I would provoke in him. So I was kind of a provocative young, a provocative son, a second son, maybe that made it more. My father was in the 8th Army and was through the 8th Army wars and battles, Anzio and so on. And I was... My politics, even as a teenager, were fairly radical. And I would be wrong to say I was anti-monarchist in those days. It went beyond that. I was so raged against the upper classes as a young fella. Nowadays, I'm probably even more radical. I don't feel in any way that watered down by that. But that kind of the sense of fighting for king and country, for me, or patriotism, that I would challenge my father all the time on that, you know. And my father, coming from that background, he hated that. I mean, so we used to have a lot of battles, typical father-son antagonistic relationship. And we had that. But he was never opposed to me as a writer, as I said earlier, because he was used to artists, you know. Mm-hmm. Artists were just people who didn't pay for the work. You know, that was my father's experience.
The book, in part, is based on a road trip through the United States. And I know that you went there, actually, with your family when you were a youngster.
Well, when I was 17, so I'd already been working for nearly 3 years, 2.5 years when I went to the States. I was an apprentice compositor, which was a really good trade in those days, you know. So I'd been away from working, but when I landed in the States, in Los Angeles, what happened was that I was unable to work. I was too young. You had to be 18 to work. That was a real problem. For one thing, it meant our family missed my earnings. It was a typical kind of immigration predicament. You know, my father had a wage and depended on the wages of the two sons, me and my elder brother, to take care of the three younger ones. My mother was taking care of the family only. So it was a very difficult time, and I found it very difficult to believe that I couldn't work. And in fact, I didn't accept it. And I used to wander around Los Angeles, basically, myself at that age. So much of Murdo being in that location type of environment is probably very much been experienced by myself when I was young, you know. Mm.
You talk about your work as a compositor, and obviously visual art's really important to you. And I wondered how it influences your writing, because the way words look on a page seems to be very, very important to you.
It was always extremely important. There was the first question that you raised there in relation to young experiences as a young, you know, from Glasgow and so on. One of the driving things for me that I'd, before sidetracking myself, was to say about the kind of freedoms that I assumed as a young artist, and I assumed the freedoms that any young artist assumes, which is the right to do your work as best you can. And that was really what I assumed. But because I came from a Glaswegian, a Scottish working class background, and attempted to be as honest as I could as a young artist, it antagonised authority to an extent that I was only really used to seeing from my father, you know, that even my attempts to use language as a young writer, however clumsy I was at the time, it was an attempt to have that liberation to write stories from within my own culture, my own experience. That was hitting the head. This was a thing you were not to do. You had to use standard English literary form. This is what you had to do as a writer. And, you know, I experienced the full hostility, even like 20 years before the outrageous hostility of the Booker Prize. I'd right from 1972, I had people who refused to publish my stories when I was 25 or 26. Mm. And for me at that time, it was really, well, why? I thought that was one of my best stories. Why would they not want to publish that? And we say, well, you know, it's anti-Christian and you're using the language of the gutter. And you think, well, when you've come from a non-conventional education, you know, and when you're only reading is the work of proper writers, maybe at that time I was reading French writers, reading American writers and so on, reading Russian writers as a young writer and as a teenager, you would be used to reading that where people are only, like any artist, are just out to try and do the thing as best they can. And what you realise is that, no, what comes first will be convention, you know, and that kind of hostility is something I suffered 40 years ago and to some extent continue to suffer. But the thing of it was, one of the things that trains you as an artist is the need for precision, the need not to be ambiguous unless it's intended, mm-hmm. and the need to take care of every article of punctuation, every single thing is mine. But for myself as a young person influenced by graphic art and as a compositor, where the form on a page is all important and how to manoeuvre words and so on and paragraphs, that for me was always absolutely crucial.
Mm. The fact that you don't use chapters, you don't use speech marks or apostrophes, I wonder how, without those conventional signifiers, how you approach the separation between dialogue and narrative.
Well, it's crucial in the context that you're saying, and that context is a context I don't often have to discuss in an interview because usually it gets missed, Georgina. So it's usually taken as a kind of style or something, whereas you go, look, this is a formal necessity. If I was to try and separate dialogue from narrative, then I could not move within the inner dynamic of the central characters. And even reviewers and critics who assume that a novel I've written has been written in a first party, and I say, well, really, it's not first party. Mm. It's a third party mm-hmm. narrative. They're not quite sure, firstly, if what I've said is true, and secondly, why I might want to raise it, because they haven't seen that's a kind of crucial thing. If I was to have punctuation in terms of dialogue, you know, in other words, quotation marks, or if I used a dash the way people like Kerouac and Joyce and others do, then it wouldn't work. It would mean I could not do it. I could not move seamlessly from a third-party objective reality through a kind of perceived third-party reality and move from there into the inner dynamic of a character. It couldn't be done. It just could not be done. And English literature, or standard English literature as opposed to English language literature, hasn't really come to terms with that. So that people like myself are out in the margins, and it's as though people have never worked out what great writers like maybe Gertrude Stein, who is a real kind of an exemplar for many writers in English language because of how she uses language and how she can manipulate English into something quite beautiful, really, in ways that people aren't used to seeing. That kind of thing that is maybe common in other language cultures or literary cultures that in English is not, simply for, I think, ultimately hierarchical reasons to do with forms of elitism. You know, it's always assumed that a writer who writes within a different linguistic format is inferior because they don't talk like the Queen or something.
Do you think that's why your Booker Prize win in 1994 was so controversial? I mean, obviously there were 4,000 uses of the word fuck, which played into it. The chair of the judges threatened to resign in protest, calling it a disgrace and frankly crap. And I wondered if winning the Booker, which is obviously a career-changing moment for anyone, was perhaps not a positive career-changing moment for you, but went in the other direction.
I suppose really both. It has been both. I feel as though, on a personal level, I feel that I would have been better without it. That's personally because it's had a negative effect on the perception of what it is I do as a writer and what I've done formerly as a writer. But then again, on the other hand, maybe that's always what happens. You know, any artist, you get kind of, there's two ways of approaching it. One is that if you're doing your work as well as you can, then really no one no ordinary reader or beholder should be aware of these formal things that you're doing. It's really only other writers or other artists you expect to go, this is what you're doing here, you know, or are you doing this? Or you go, well, yeah. But you don't really want, it's not to be seen there. You're not exhibiting technique. So when you do something that is difficult formally, you don't need it to be applauded. But what happened to myself with the Booker was basically the opposite of that, you know, that... whereas someone like, whether it was Joyce or where they would be, the work would be seen to be what it was or what was going on. For myself, I experienced the opposite. I had the real kind of horrible elitism, which was people saying, "Do you ever revise?" And that was people saying that who were academics, you know, English academics, which is a really peculiar thing to say to any writer. But for me, it was also the question you have to, the question that forces itself on you is really, why would they not notice what it is I'm doing? Do they not realise what I'm doing? Because it's part of, this is part of the English language tradition. If they don't know what I'm doing, then How do they know what these other writers are doing? How do they know what maybe Zora Huston or Faulkner or someone, do they know what they're doing? I don't think they actually know. Or maybe they do, but when it comes to within the UK, what's going on here? What is it about society in the UK that means that any writer who operates in the way that I do or tries to be, to use language in this, in the way that I do, two things. One, because of the language as it's taken, it's never seen to be artifice in a sense, or because of the lives of the people that you're dealing with, because they're unworthy. They're thought to be it's like whoever it was that said about, you know, we don't want to hear about people like that, you know, about whether it was the central character and How Late It Was, or whether it was a central character in an earlier novel of mine where the Booker Prize judge, that would be 1984, a novel of mine called Busking Dr. Hines. The judge, or the chair, in fact, he came out and said, I'm not bothered saying what he said, but you wonder why, how could people involved at that level be so provoked by what it is you're doing, that it's like all areas of their training as critics have gone. And they're no longer able to actually see it. It's red rag to a bull, or the red mist has descended, whatever that metaphor is, really. But they don't realise that to do what you've done is might be tricky.
You've in the past talked about the cultural elite, the fact that the literary society is run by a very small amount of people from London generally, a kind of new cultural imperialism, I suppose, in a way. Yeah. And I wondered if that was behind your decision to change publishers and go with a Scottish publisher.
Well, it wasn't just my own decision. It was also coming to the end of a time and realising that, but it was very mutual, you know, I must say. It's not that I had a choice in that. And it was a great thing for me, but at the same time, it was simply because I think the publishers no longer found it viable to publish me down here. But, you know, going back to the thing about the... just in terms of what it is you're doing, the way in which you see this as an extremely political thing that's going on is when you're back to what you may have studied if you're doing maybe philosophy of language or something. It's to do with value. It's the values that come through in the language that I'm using. So the language I'm using becomes... It's an attack in conventional value. It's an attack in those... who believe society is theirs, they dictate everything. So that I became aware also that the people whose work that, who are doing work along, you know, that I would say, God, oh, that's similar to what I'm doing. You become aware of people like Jean Genet. Mm-hmm. You become aware that some of the great writers who had to fight against male or conventional male value, or the value of the males who are in power within society, are the dominant male culture. They own value. Value is theirs. And any challenge to that, and that's what you become aware of. It doesn't matter if it's because you're writing as a gay man, or if you're writing as a gay woman, or if you're coming just from an ordinary female, whether you're lesbian or not, as soon as you're challenging value, that male value, you're in a limb somewhere. You're like Virginia Woolf, you're Gertrude Stein, or you're someone who, you walk into company and you will be attacked. You will have to deal with that. Mm. You will deal with hostility, and you don't have to come from Kenya, or from Glasgow, or in everyone else's case, Edinburgh, or if it's the Caribbean, or anywhere there, or the American South, you will be challenged because the existence of your work is a challenge to the dominant authority. And that's what you become aware of. When you become aware of that also, you realise that you're involved. It becomes even wider because it becomes almost like a 19th century struggle. It takes you into things like, without belabouring a point, it takes you into existentialist theory and so on. It takes you into areas about what is reality, or however it takes you well to work these things out. As an artist, you become self-conscious, not by choice, but it's like because you're forced to confront hostility. Mm. And that forces you to look at what you're doing, because ultimately you go, well, why is it I'm being attacked here? I thought I was doing my best, and I thought I'd done a story that might pass muster here, or I thought I'd created a painting that people would really enjoy. Instead of that, they're upset. Why are they upset, you know?
Dirt Road, your latest book, isn't upsetting people yet. It's had some very positive reviews. It has your work generally, but this book in particular has such a clear rhythm. And I know that one of the main themes of the book is about the power of music. And I just wondered what your relationship with music is. Is it something that's very meaningful to you? And do you write to music?
No, I don't write to music. I'll answer that first, unless the music is important to the characters or something within the work I'm doing. I do like the music that's mentioned in the novel, but I have a very kind of eclectic feel towards music, really. I don't favour one area rather than another. It's been interesting to me that Zydeco music is not as known and not as Cajun as maybe I thought they were. I kind of thought they were better known than they are. Or conjunto music, or music from the Appalachian style music that is, you know, that is not just done for a joke, or treated with forms of contempt. So the music, in a way, it's always been really important to me anyway, you know, but I don't think it's any more. There's nothing that's going on. I don't think I have any particular sensibility to music, rather. I tend to see it more to do with art in general terms, mm. and I always feel I just pay attention.
And it's not just literature that you're involved in, because this book, this wonderful book, Dirt Road, has been made into a film called Dirt Road to Lafayette. It's directed by the BAFTA winner, Kenny Glenner. Now, this it seemed to be worked on at the same time as the book. Were you writing it with a film in mind then?
No, it came about, I was working on both. The screenplay came first. The idea came first. And I worked on as a screenplay because the idea came about with Kenny Glenan, the director. So it was Kenny telling me about a guy he'd met, a musician, who had mentioned to him that when he was 14, he'd spent a couple of weeks with his dad in the States, you know, and he'd come to know blues music through that. And that idea kind of was a major spark for myself, and that's kick-started me in the writing of a screenplay. I could then come in with all my own sort of a boyhood or teenage experience, and I have written other screenplays and other drama, so it's I'm not unused to the form, and I work in both forms. But prose is what excites me most, and it is most my own. So it wasn't long before I was also working on a novel, but the novel, I regard the two of them as separate entities, really, in a way. The screenplay, in that sense, is not a screenplay of the novel, and the novel is not a novelisation of the screenplay, you know. And I think that would be quite... It wouldn't be possible anyway, because the way Kenny directs and that I write a novel, I need to do everything in a novel, in the same way as a director has to do everything in a movie.
And the novel is out now. It's Dirt Road. It's published by Canongate. Very many thanks to you, to the author, James Kalman.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks very much to sound engineer Toby Hammond. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website, from our app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.